Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about commitment problems, which will constitute our first answer to the question, why isn't there less conflict between states? On the first slide, you'll see the two goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to demonstrate, using a game theoretic model, that the expectation of a future shift in power can lead to war in the present. Second, I'll discuss how commitment problems explain the occurrence of war in the real world. I'll do that first with an historical example, the American Civil War, and then provide evidence that the argument holds more generally by presenting the results of statistical analysis that I've performed. First, though, let me clarify what a commitment problem is. The idea here is that no one can credibly commit to do something in the future that very clearly won't be in their interests at that time. That's true even if it is presently in their interests to promise that they would. To take an example from everyday life, before we try applying the concept to international relations, suppose that you're away on holiday and you accidentally leave your wallet in your hotel room. You're out doing your touristy thing, and you pass a charming little cafe. You'd like to grab a coffee, or a proper cup, or whatever your beverage of choice is. But you don't have any money, or a credit card. What if you promise the owner, who's working the counter themselves, that you'll come back tomorrow to settle your tab? Are they likely to serve you? Probably not. If you lived there and were a regular customer, they might. They might not even ask you to pay double next time. Just give it to you for free and hope that makes you a more loyal customer, which will help them out in the long run. But if you're just passing through, probably headed off to another city tomorrow, forget about it. Hopefully the owner will be polite when they decline, but they're going to decline. Because they know you ain't coming back to pay for that coffee or tea. Why would you? You may honestly intend to in that moment when you're desperate for caffeine, but once tomorrow rolls around and your plan is to be elsewhere, the odds of you taking the time to head back to that cafe to settle a small tab are close to nil. But if there was some way for you to convince the owner that you would, if promises were inherently credible, which I'm sorry to say, they're not, then you'd both be better off. You'd get your beverage, and they'd get the small amount of profit they make off a cup of coffee or tea. The fact that you can't commit, at least not credibly, to returning tomorrow makes both of you worse off. It presents a commitment problem. So how does this apply to war? Well, in two different ways, one of which is straightforward. Commitment problems can arise when it's difficult to verify whether the terms of an agreement are being upheld. So, for example, if one state is sponsoring a terrorist group that targets the civilian population of another state, then even though the two countries would be better off reaching some agreement whereby the one government severs ties with the terrorist group and perhaps takes action to disarm them, we might still expect the second to invade them, because they'd know that a promise from the first to stop supporting the terrorists is not necessarily credible. If the state that's been sponsoring terrorism knows that it can keep doing so in secret and have a good chance of getting away with it, then they're probably going to do so. Their inability to commit to severing ties with the group is going to get them invaded. That's never good. And while the other state is better off invading than not, given the likelihood of future attacks, the best outcome for them would obviously be peace if they could get an ironclad commitment from the other country to stop supporting the terrorists. So it's the fact that no such commitment is possible that leads to a war neither side really wants. The other, more nuanced example of a commitment problem causing a war has to do with shifting power. This argument is a little trickier, so we're going to use a game theoretic model to articulate the logic. I do that because I myself didn't truly understand this argument until I'd worked through a few models, and I've never met anyone, not a single person, who could convince me that they did either. You might prefer that I skip the model because you hate maths, but I care enough about trying to get at least some of you to really understand this argument in all its nuance that I'm going to present it to you in the only format I know of that has ever gotten anyone to a state of true comprehension. Okay, onto the model, which is described on the third slide. This is a more advanced version of the model I used in the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict. We've got two players, a challenger and a defender, one of whom gets to offer terms, or issue an ultimatum, or execute a fait accompli, while the other gets to respond. But here, we have two stages, and the challenger has an additional choice in each of them. Rather than simply choosing how much to demand by setting the size of X, C can now decide whether to make a demand at all, because they can also choose to attack outright instead. If they do so in the first stage, we might think of that as preventive war, but only in the sense that they're trying to prevent D from becoming as powerful as it looks like they otherwise would. War wouldn't be preventing an imminent attack by D, which is what you might think I mean by preventive war. That's an important distinction. You'll often hear people argue about whether China is likely to attack the US or any of its allies once it becomes stronger. One of the implications of this argument is that that's sort of besides the point. So long as continued growth allows China to demand that the US offer better terms whenever the two find themselves disagreeing about important issues, then the US potentially has an incentive to fight a preventive war. I'm not saying I necessarily expect it to do so, because such a war would be incredibly costly, both in the conventional sense and in terms of opportunity costs. Both sides benefit a great deal from their current cooperative relations. But asking whether the rising state has overtly hostile intentions, whether they would launch an unprovoked attack on the state that's currently on top, isn't really the right question. What matters is whether the costs of war are large enough to offset the benefit of guaranteeing yourself better outcomes in the future by achieving a goal in the present that can only be achieved through force, slowing the other side down by wreaking havoc on them and their economy. So, C can either start a war right away or offer terms of their choosing. Because they can do that in each stage, we need to add subscripts. So X1 represents the terms C offers, if they do at all, in the first stage, while X2 represents the terms they offer in the second stage. And those don't need to be the same. In fact, there's no reason they would be, because circumstances change between the first and second stage of the game. Specifically, D is going to get stronger. How much stronger depends on whether C slows them down by waging a war against them. In both stages, D can either accept or reject C's terms, if any are offered. Accepting means the stage ends peacefully. Rejecting means the stage ends in war. Whatever happens in the first stage, there's going to be a second. And whatever happens in the second, the game ends. We could, of course, let it go on indefinitely. I've analyzed such models in some of my research. They're nasty. So let's keep it simple and cut things off after the second stage. That's all we need to develop the basic argument. So there are four possible outcomes. Peace in both stages, War in the first, but not the second. War in the second, but not the first. And war in both. So peace one, peace two means that both stages ended peacefully. As in, the challenger chose to offer terms in both cases, and the defender accepted those terms each time. Peace 1, War 2 means that the challenger offered terms that were accepted in the first stage, but either attacked outright or made an offer that the defender rejected in the second stage. It turns out that would never happen, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. For now, I'm just telling you how to read the table and explaining the structure and assumptions of the model. I've already told you what the X's mean, but I'll explain them again in a slightly different way, just to make sure we're all on the same page. X1 is how close to their most preferred outcome C will be in the first stage if they offer terms and those terms are accepted. X2 is how close to their most preferred outcome they'll be in the second stage if they offer terms and those terms are accepted. The C terms mean exactly what they did when I first introduced them. If you need to refresh your memory, then go back to the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict. It's with the W terms that things get tricky. First of all, I've added subscripts, as I have with the X's, and for the same reason. That's straightforward enough. W1, then, means exactly what W did in the first lecture on conflict, except that it only applies to the outcome of a war in the first stage. It tells us how much of what C wanted they'd actually managed to take by force if they fight a war in the first stage. Though, of course, their overall level of satisfaction after doing so also depends on how much utility they lose due to the cost of war. W2, generically, is how close C came to getting their most preferred outcome as a result of fighting a war in the second stage, no different than W1 for the first stage. But you'll note there are two different versions of W2. They're not color-coded this time either, because the reason we need to differentiate between them has nothing to do with different versions of D that C thinks they might be facing. In this model, there's no uncertainty. Both C and D, by assumption, know everything there is to know about one another. Is that realistic? No. But it's useful to demonstrate that war could occur even if everyone knew everything. That is, in this model, wars are not mistakes. They can be in reality, and we'll analyze a theoretical model that takes that possibility seriously in another lecture. But here, they're not. The difference between W2 overline and W2 underline is what happened in the first stage. More specifically, W2 overline is the outcome of a war in the second stage if a war was also fought in the first stage, whereas W2 underline is the outcome of a war in the second stage if the first stage ended peacefully. And as is always true in this module, the version of W2 with a line under it is smaller than the version of W2 with a line over it. Incidentally, we also assume that both versions of W2 are smaller than W1. What does that mean? Well, I've assumed that C is never going to be in a better position against D than it is at the beginning of the game. Power is shifting in D's favor, and nothing can stop that. But C can slow that down some. That is, how much worse of a position they'll be in come the second stage depends on what happens in the first. for W1 to drop to W2 overline isn't as bad as for it to drop to W2 underline. Substantively, that means I've assumed that if the challenger fights a war against the defender soon, they'll knock them off course and slow their growth. Wars have a tendency to do that, though the evidence suggests that it's purely a short-term effect. Over a long enough time horizon, states catch back up to the path they were on. Think, for example, about how World War I occurred in part because of Germany's rapid rise, but of course, so did World War II. Punitive as the reparations scheme at the end of World War I was, Germany still caught back up to Great Britain, and eventually did so yet again. So, if C fights a war in the first stage, the outcome they can expect from a war in the second stage, should one occur, is a bit better. They still won't be in as good a position as they were in the first stage. W2 overline is less than W1. But it's not as bad for C as if they'd done nothing to slow D down. That right there is the heart of the story. Remembering the differences between the W's is critical to understanding the argument overall. The table should be easy enough to interpret at this point. If C offers terms in both stages, and they're accepted both times, C gets x1 plus x2, leaving D with 1 minus x1 plus 1 minus x2. If either stage ends in war, we replace the appropriate x with the appropriate w and penalize both sides for incurring the costs of war. I'm not going to talk through the rest of the table line by line, cell by cell, but you might want to stop here and look at it for a while until you're sure everything makes sense to you. Ready? Okay, let's move on to the next slide. What we want to do now is apply backwards induction. So we start with the last decision and work our way back to the first. In this case, that means we start by asking, when would D be willing to let C have x2? The answer is when D expects to lose less by giving up x2 than by fighting. So as long as C isn't trying to get them to give up too much, D is going to give in. What's too much? That depends on what D would give up if they resist. Nothing new here besides the subscripts and the fact that we need to distinguish between two different versions of W. If C fought a preventive war in the first stage, then D expects to lose W2 overline. And of course they're going to feel as though they also lost CD because war is costly. So we can say that if the first stage ended in war, D accepts C's terms in the second stage so long as C does not set x2 larger than x2 overline, which by definition is equal to w2 overline plus CD. And if the first stage ended peacefully, then D only expects to lose W2 underline, though they still have to pay the cost of war if they resist, so D isn't willing to give up as much. Here, C cannot set X2 larger than X2 underline, which by definition is equal to W2 underline plus CD, if they want D to accept. Note that x2 underline is strictly less than x2 overline because w2 underline is less than w2 overline. And what that means substantively is that the challenger can get the defender to give in to larger demands or expect them to let bolder fait accompli stand if the challenger launches a preventive war in the first stage. Again, it's a loss of bargaining power that C is preventing if C goes to war on the first stage. Not necessarily a direct threat to their homeland or anything, as we discussed a bit earlier. If they don't fight, they aren't going to be able to secure peace on equally favorable terms in the second stage. They're going to have to settle for X2 underline when they could have had X2 overline. That leads us to the first important result. This model provides no expectation of war in the second stage. Once power has shifted, the damage is done. There's nothing left to prevent. And since war remains costly, we expect the second stage to end in peace. More formally, C's optimal choice of X2 is W2 plus CD, where the version of W2 that goes into that depends on how the first stage ended. Put differently, C either sets X2 precisely equal to W2 overline plus CD, if there was war in the first stage, or precisely equal to W2 underline plus CD, if there wasn't. But either way, they're offering the best possible terms from their perspective that they can get D to accept. And D will, in fact, accept those terms, whichever ones they are. Why is that? Well, for exactly the same reason that C never provoked wars in the model of crisis bargaining from the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict. War is inefficient. Nothing can be achieved through fighting in the second stage that could be achieved through peace and at lower cost. So we expect peace to prevail. Of course, I told you at the outset that I was going to offer an explanation for war in this lecture, so obviously something more interesting has to happen in the first stage. And indeed it does, some of the time. Turn to the next slide. At this point, it shouldn't surprise you to hear me say that D is going to accept C's terms in the first stage, so long as doing so doesn't require them to give up too much, where too much reflects what they would have given up anyway if they rejected C's terms. The one wrinkle is that fighting a war doesn't just require them to give up some amount of territory right now, in addition to spending lots of money and suffering some amount of fatalities. Fighting a war also has long-term implications, because it's going to slow down their economic growth, and they won't be as powerful in the second stage as they could have been. The desire to keep growing at their current pace gives D another reason to avoid war, beyond the obvious desire to avoid bloodshed. And that grants C leverage over D. More formally, the largest demand that's acceptable to D in the first stage, X1 hat, includes the difference between W2 overline and W2 underline, because that difference is exactly how much future power D gives up by allowing C to slow them down. They're willing to trade away some amount of territory now in exchange for continuing to grow rapidly, because that will ensure that they won't need to give up as much in the future. Aside from the difference between the two W2s, though, what you're looking at is almost exactly the same as X hat in the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict, except that we have to put a 1 in the subscript for our original W and X. The other point here is that this expression can potentially take on values greater than 1. That was actually true before as well, but I didn't mention it because it wouldn't have made any difference. In the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict, if X hat, which is definitionally equal to W plus CD, came to a number greater than 1, well, then C would just set X equal to 1, which D would be all too happy to accept, because they'd feel as though they'd lost even more than that if they resisted, and our substantive conclusion would still be the same. C asks for the most they can get away with, which would now be their most preferred outcome, and war doesn't occur. But here, that's not necessarily the case. We actually do have to consider what happens when it's logically impossible for C to demand that D give up as much territory as D would feel as though they'd lost if they were to resist. Because here, we can't just assume that C is willing to settle for their most preferred outcome. Wait, what? How can the challenger not be willing to settle for their most preferred outcome? Isn't that sort of by definition their most preferred outcome? Well, yes, it is, in the short run. Put differently, X1 hat tells us how much utility D feels as though they lose if they fight a war. That can be more than the utility they lose if they allow C to demand their most preferred outcome. And that matters because if C chooses the path of peace, they allow D to keep growing. And that's going to come back to bite them in the behind in the future. The only reason C would be willing to let D keep growing, to forego the opportunity to slow them down by bombing the heck out of them, is if C can be compensated for that. If X1 hat is less than 1, that's possible. D essentially says, I'll make larger concessions today to make up for the fact that I won't be willing to do so tomorrow, if that's what it takes to convince you not to go to war. And C is fine with that, when that's actually possible. But when D would have been willing to give C everything that C wants in the short run anyway, then they can't top that off. There's no way to sweeten the deal when it's already as sweet as it gets. And if D can't find some way to compensate C now for the additional concessions they'd get later if and only if they go to war against D, well, then C is going to go to war. In other words, the defender's inability to offer the challenger anything more than the challenger's most preferred outcome can, at times, end up causing a war that no one really wants. A war that could have been avoided if it was possible for the defender to promise that they'd agree to the same terms in the future if they're allowed to reach their full potential, as they would have if their economy had instead been crippled by a war. The defender here is a lot like the tourist who promises to come back tomorrow to pay for the coffee they want to consume today. The owner doesn't expect them to do so because it really wouldn't be in their interest to. And the challenger doesn't expect the defender to make bonus concessions tomorrow in order to avoid getting attacked today, because there'd be no reason for them to do so. So, when does that actually cause a war? First of all, X1 hat has to be greater than 1. Because again, if it's not, that means that the defender can compensate the challenger for passing up an opportunity to ensure future benefits by slowing D down, simply by offering them bigger concessions right now. But when X1 hat is greater than 1, they can't. Even then, though, it depends on whether that last inequality at the very bottom of the slide holds, which it might, but it might not. If that's dissatisfying to you, I suggest you go back and listen to the first couple of lectures again. We don't want our theoretical model to tell us that war always makes sense. If it did, we'd be trying to explain something that varies with something that doesn't. We don't even want it to say that war often makes sense, because wars are rare. It should be telling us that wars occur under a very narrow set of conditions. Ones that usually won't occur, but sometimes, every once in a great while, will. And that's exactly what this model does. In fact, we don't just want a model that sometimes says yes, but usually says no. That's important. But what we really want is a model that gives us a sense of when crises are most likely to result in war, that tells us which ones are going to be violent. The model I analyzed in the optional lecture on symbolic and electoral distortions was perfectly capable of accounting for the fact that some crises escalate to war whilst others do not. But it wasn't very satisfying because the specific patterns it led us to expect are mostly at odds with the best available evidence, with our current sense of what has happened historically. So the question now is whether this preventive war story does any better. And in the remainder of this lecture, I'm going to try to convince you that it does. Before we move on, though, let's just spend a few minutes taking a closer look at the final inequality, because that's going to tell us exactly what we're looking for when we try to evaluate the empirical implications of the model, when we compare its expectations to what has actually happened in the real world. That inequality tells us when C is willing to settle in the first stage for its most preferred outcome. When that inequality is satisfied, war therefore does not occur. Put differently, the model tells us that war occurs when that inequality is not satisfied, when the left-hand side is less than the right-hand side. You can think of the left-hand side, then, as the pro-peace column. On the one hand, C gets its most preferred outcome. That's the one. On the other, they get to avoid incurring the costs of war. That's the CC. The right-hand side is the pro-war column. The closer to its most preferred outcome C will come anyway, even if they fight, the more attractive war is. That's why W1 is on the right-hand side. And the bigger the difference between the terms C can ask for after slowing D down and the ones they can ask for when they don't, the more attractive war in the first stage is. That's why the difference between W2 overline and W2 underline is there. So what we're looking for when we identify general patterns in the historical record using statistical analysis is for war to be more likely when the state that's currently in a good position is in a very good position, as well as when the difference between how strong they'd be relative to the other country if they fight a war this year and how strong they'd be if they don't is particularly large. Now let's talk about the American Civil War. Doing so doesn't allow us to evaluate whether the patterns anticipated by the model hold in general, because it's just one case, but I hope you'll find it interesting, and that you'll agree that the commitment problem story is useful for understanding this particular case, that it tells us something we wouldn't have appreciated otherwise, and thus helps us understand the world better. As I argued in the lecture on avoidable costs of conflict, it's one thing to say that slavery was the primary issue over which the U.S. Civil War was fought, and with very insincere apologies to any neo-Confederates out there, it very clearly was. It's quite another to say that slavery was the cause of the war. The first 85 years of U.S. history basically consist of one crisis after another revolving around slavery, all of which ended peacefully. At the Constitutional Convention of 1787, one of the key questions was how to count the population of the states, which would influence the size of their delegations in the House of Representatives as well as the Electoral College. The northern states wanted to count freemen and freemen only, to treat slaves as non-people for these purposes, because that would give the southern states less influence. The most preferred outcome for the South was to give slaves equal weight to freemen. Not because they saw slaves as their equals overall, they obviously didn't, but treating them as such for this purpose would give the southern states more power politically. The decision to count 3/5 of the slave population towards the state's overall population, then, can be seen as a compromise, as the North offering the South a pretty big concession in order to keep them in the Union. And every time the U.S. expanded territorially, a new compromise was struck. Now, you might be thinking, fine, but that was unsustainable, especially once the abolition movement really got going. At a certain point, you just don't want to compromise anymore. Fair enough, I suppose, in principle, but if that's your position, you've got the small problem of there being very clear evidence against your interpretation of why this war occurred, and the willingness of the North to continue compromising with the South. As late as April of 1861, attempts at compromise were still being made, the first in the form of the Crittenden proposal, and the second, the Corwin Amendment, which came after the southern states had already seceded. The Corwin Amendment prohibited any other amendments that might authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of said state. In other words, it would have made any abolition of slavery illegal. And Congress passed it. It didn't get through enough state legislatures to become an amendment before the war was fully underway, rendering it moot. But the point is, this attempt at a last-minute compromise had more than a little support. Moreover, in contrast to what they teach kids in the U.S., the attack on Fort Sumter didn't mark the official start of the Civil War. Not in any meaningful sense. President Abraham Lincoln met with his cabinet after that attack, and though some of his advisors did call for war, he himself sided with those who advocated sticking with the original plan of forcing the southern states to come crawling back on their own by choking off their economy with a naval blockade. His plan was to shut down the cotton trade, which was, of course, the life's blood of the southern economy. That was what made slavery so important in the first place. Lincoln's belief was that if the South couldn't export cotton to Europe, especially the United Kingdom, their economy would collapse and they'd give up. It was several weeks after Confederate forces fired on a U.S. military installation that President Lincoln actually authorized the use of force. So what made him change his mind? The desire to prevent a shift in power, just like in the theoretical model. That loss of power would have come from formal British recognition of the Confederacy, which likely would have been followed by military or economic assistance. A member of Her Majesty's government communicated to the U.S. Secretary of State, William Seward, that Great Britain had no desire to meddle in any state's internal affairs, but it was starting to look like that wasn't the best way to view things, since the Union hadn't really reacted to the secession. And since the British economy was heavily reliant on cotton imports from the South, the British government was none too happy with Lincoln's naval blockade. Basically, the British said, if not in so many words, that the South would gain a powerful ally if, and only if, the North let that stage of the crisis end peacefully. Choosing war thus meant that the North could dictate terms to the South later on that it would never have been able to otherwise. And that's when Lincoln chose to go to war. Sounds a lot like the reason war occurs in the theoretical model, doesn't it? I hope that helps some of you see the argument more clearly. I know for many of you, it's easier to relate to specific examples than it is statistical analysis. But that is just one case, and the better way to evaluate arguments is to look at how well they do overall. So let's now turn to the statistical analysis I performed. On the sixth slide, you'll see a description of the data I used. I analyzed all dyad years, you should know what that means by now, from 1821 to 1913, and from 1946 to 2007. The gap in the middle is to avoid the world wars, which present statistical complications. The other bounds are due to data availability. Basically, I've pooled together 9 decades worth of data prior to World War I, and another 6 after World War II. Within those 2 periods, I've got data on every pair of countries in the world. The dependent variable, what we're trying to explain, is whether the 2 states in the dyad were major participants on opposite sides in an interstate war that began in that year. I've got over 420,000 dyad years, and only 56 of them meet these criteria. As I've said many times, war is, thankfully, quite rare. This measure is based on the Correlates of War Project's interstate war data, which you can find online if you're interested. Just go to www.correlatesofwar.org, click on Available Datasets there on the left, then click on the new COW war data, which is the 3rd link from the top. I've excluded states that COW lists as participants if they suffered less than 10% of their side's fatalities, unless that state fought by itself for an extended period of time. So New Zealand's token contribution to Vietnam, Ethiopia's participation in the Korean War, they're out. Whatever drives that sort of behavior, I doubt it's the argument I laid out in this lecture. I should probably clarify at this point what the different types of war are according to the COW data. I told you I would way back in the first lecture. Interstate wars involve 2 recognized members of the international system. Intrastate wars take place entirely within 1 member of the international system. That's just another term for civil wars. Extrastate wars involve a formal member of the international system, a state, and some other non-state actor that isn't situated within their borders. This includes wars of decolonization, the latter phases of the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so on. Right now, though, we're just looking at interstate, and only when participation in the war is more than symbolic. There are a few important independent variables this time. First, I have a measure of the current share of military capabilities, which roughly proxies for W1, at least if we're willing to assume that states with greater military capabilities tend to get what they want from war, which, admittedly, isn't always the case, particularly in wars of counterinsurgency, but it is true often enough to make this reasonable. I've also got measures of the likely distributions of military capabilities in the following year, should a war be fought this year, and if one is not. These proxy for W2 overline and W2 underline, respectively. So we're looking for MILCAP share and likely H to be positively associated with our dependent variable, but for likely L to be negatively associated with it. Those are the 3 factors on the pro-war side of the inequality. How are those things measured? Well, I won't go into too much detail, but basically, I've got an M score for each state. I mentioned those previously. Again, the M scores take into account personnel and spending relative to the standards of the time. You can see what the M scores look like for a few of the more powerful states on the next slide, in case you're interested. I'm not going to spend time discussing it, but it's there if you want to take a look. The MILCAP share variable is simply the proportion of dyadic military capabilities that the stronger state possesses. So that ranges from 50% when the 2 states are evenly matched to 100% when one of them is completely preponderant over the other. The likely scores are predictions I generated from a statistical model whose dependent variable was MILCAP share and whose independent variables included the previous year's share, the rate at which it was changing, and whether a war was fought, as well as various complicated functions thereof. On to the results. What this table tells us is that when we look at the 420,000 plus dyad years from 1821 to 1913 and 1946 to 2007, we find that wars, as I've chosen to measure them, occur more often in the presence of higher values of likely age, which is an estimate of what the stronger state's share of military capabilities will be a year later if a war is fought this year, and occur less frequently in the presence of higher values of likely L, which is an estimate of what the stronger state's share of military capabilities will be a year later, if not. That is, there's a statistically significant positive association between war and the variable we're using to stand in for W-2 overline, as there should be, and a statistically significant negative relationship between war and the variable we're using to stand in for W-2 underline, as there should be. The MILCAP share variable appears to be positively related to war, but the pattern of association is so weak that we could easily observe it by random chance, even if the truth was that there was no relationship at all. So that's what we're going to assume. That is, the lack of an asterisk means the relationship is not statistically significant. That's actually not terribly surprising for reasons that will become clear after the lecture on information problems, but I'll wait till then to say anything more about it. For now, I'll just close by saying a few words about the explanatory power of commitment problems stemming from an expectation of a future shift in power. The statistical analysis tells us that wars in the real world have occurred more often under the conditions most associated with commitment problems. When fighting a war today puts the stronger state in a good position tomorrow, but failing to do so would come at a real price. But those conditions don't emerge too often. I think we've got a real explanation for war here, and I hope that I've convinced you that thinking in these terms gives us a better understanding of some specific cases, like the American Civil War. But the statistical analysis I just described doesn't account for much variation. In other words, I just walked you through a very persuasive account of why war might occur under conditions that don't arise terribly often. So it's a useful explanation in the sense that it's logically consistent, and the things we'd expect to see if it was right are in fact evident in the historical record. And when those conditions are met, war is much more likely to occur than it otherwise would be. But most wars are probably happening for a different reason.